The views and opinions expressed on Gaza Corner are those of me, Dori Stein, and my guests tonight, Neely Belkin, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of a KALW Public Media. Neely is an author, an ethnomusicologist, co-curator of The Rough Guide to Palestine, a wonderful CD. And last week, we covered a lot of topics, including living in Jaffa today, where Neely is living right now and calling in from, I should say Zooming in from. And also, we spoke about her experience living during the air raids during the 12-day, and I hope it's only something in history now and nothing that can happen again, but the 12-day Israeli war on Iran. And also, we did a deep dive into the history of Jaffa, which was a Palestinian city that suffered the most in terms of ethnic cleansing during the Nakba prior to the creation of Israel. And Neely also spoke about her activist work protecting shepherds threatened by settler violence and theft. And if you'd like a copy of that audio, you can always email me at tangentsradio@gmail.com. So Neely, welcome back. Hello there.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me again.
Yeah.
Jaffa is a very special place for me. I don't know if it's the one that suffered most ethnic cleansing, but it's certainly because there were whole villages that just evaporated, right, during the 1948 war. But what it has suffered is more of Israel government taking away, confiscating properties than probably any other location. I think something like 26, if I'm not wrong, percent of the properties that were confiscated and nationalized have been in Jaffa. And so that is very true in that sense.
Yeah, I was referring to the, when you include the surrounding areas, the population was 120,000, not all Palestinian, but majority, and 97% were evicted forcibly by continual bombing for about a four-month period in the beginning of 1948, prior to the creation of Israel. And something like 750,000 to 800,000 Palestinians were forcibly expelled during the Nakba. And as I say, 97% of 120,000 from Jaffa and the surrounding areas. I was really interested in learning that you discovered well into adulthood that you're from an extended Jewish and Palestinian family in Ramallah and Nazareth, other places that you didn't even know about. So how did that discovery happen? And what, if anything, has changed in your life after that?
Okay, well, let me start with my original family, the one that I grew up with as an Israeli Jew, then American, which is my father's family, rather, came to Palestine in 1882. They are sort of considered, if you want to make this the equation, the kind of that the Mayflower or something like that. It was a group of 14 people. Eight of them had my last name, who came to start a new country in the middle of, you know, 14 people, right? It's kind of revolutionary, kind of strange. And they were called Bilu. It was a particular group that's really been considered in Israeli terminology, the first Aliyah, or the first group who came over. And then during World War I, they were two families, one is mine and another family from another place, were the first to begin a spying group that was, because they figured like the Ottoman Empire was sort of falling apart and that they needed a new sponsor or new support in the area, they started a spying group that was called Neely, like my name. And they spied for the British against the Turks. And, you know, my grandfather's brother was hanged for this. My grandfather managed to skip from a moving train and run away and walk all the way from Damascus through Lebanon to Palestine and so on. So these are very, very dramatic stories. His cousin tried to reach British lines over the Sinai Desert because at some point communication with the British were severed, and he, dressed as a Bedouin, and his story is also really interesting because he was raised in a Palestinian madrasa and then by a Bedouin sheikh, and then anyway, he was killed by other Bedouins while trying to cross the lines. He had become a saint for Bedouin women in the area because he had a palm tree sort of growing out of his pocket, and it was the only palm tree in an area of sand dunes in the Sinai, and it was known as burial place of the Jew. Okay, so I have all these characters in my Zionist family which have whose stories have become told and retold because they are interesting stories, and they tell a lot about the shift from Ottoman period to the British Mandate period in Palestine, and then later on other things as well. So, my grandfather was the kind of grandfather that you would take to school with you because everybody would be interested in his stories as a British spy in World War I. And he was actually in the Turkish military when he was doing that. He was the first Palestinian or Jew from Palestine to join the Turkish military and become a soldier. So, kind of interesting characters, interesting family, right? And then fast forward to I left Israel in 1983. I was a soldier myself during the first Lebanon War, and I didn't want to have anything to do with this place after Sabra and Shatila. It was too difficult for me. I didn't want to live here, and I left.
Explain the massacre that made you, that was a catalyst. Not everyone knows what you're referring to.
Okay, so the 1982, 1983 First Lebanon War was a campaign to get the PLO out of Lebanon, right? And it was supposed to be about safekeeping the Galilee, but it didn't stay just close to the Galilee border. They went all the way to Beirut in order to get rid of the PLO, which actually then had moved the PLO leadership, which then had moved to Tunis. And one of the things that happened there is that in Sabra and Shatila, which were two Palestinian refugee camps, the Israeli troops under Ariel Sharon, they allowed Christian militias who went and slaughtered, and they actually provided lighting and so on for them to slaughter all the Palestinian refugees in those refugee camps.
Was that something that you knew, but most Israelis didn't really know the role of the Israelis, or they knew
No, they
and they
actually
approved
did.
it?
No, they actually did. And this was the first demonstration that was a mega demonstration in Israel. We're talking 400,000 people, and I was there, was against Israel's role in Sabra and Shatila. I think it was the first time that people were facing the narratives that they had been told and believed, because, we're talking in an era that there wasn't a lot of other sources of information other than official information, the one TV channel that they had, and so on, right? It was very minimal, the kind of exposure that people had to information. The new historians that revised Israel's history came in the 1980s later. So it was a big shock for a lot of people, for a lot of people, as
And
well
that
as.
was a big reason you decided to leave Israel.
Yes, that and my own experiences in the military, which we don't need to get into here,
Yeah,
but
yeah.
it was very clear to me that I don't want to. What was clear to me was I don't know that I had a very well-formed political agenda, but I knew one thing. For me, Sabra and Shatila was key for that. I knew that I don't want to be a predator and I don't want to be a victim. And in a place where that calls on you to be one or the other, I just couldn't live there. That's how I felt, and I left.
Transition, if you can, to I mean, I think the New York experience definitely impacts how you dealt with learning about your Palestinian extended family. But how did that transition happen?
Well, that transition happened in 2011 when I was actually here doing my field work for my book, which it's about music and conflict, or music in conflict, Palestine and Israel. And I had already come here with my own ideas of what I wanted to do, and understanding that I need to really get into do deep field work with folks who come from very different positions and viewpoints, including in the West Bank with Palestinian conservatories, including in Israel with projects of coexistence and so on. So what I did was, in the middle of all of this, my father gets a phone call from another relative who tells him that this woman from Nazareth, her name is Hannah, came to visit her and that she thinks that we're relatives. And the reason that she thinks that is because her grandfather actually had been given to a Palestinian church in Haifa, given away as a baby. And that kid was adopted by the woman who ran the school of the church. And what happened, this was around 1926, and ever since then, he tried to find his biological family, and he was not successful. And Hanan carried his work in trying to find this family because, in his name, she wanted to kind of respect her grandfather in that way. There were various ways in which his name, his original biological name, the name that he was given before he was adopted, which it was close to us. And then she searched and she found the whole family history. And as I told you, my family is kind of mythical in some ways. And in at the Rishon LeZion Museum, which Rishon LeZion is the first town that was formed by Belu settlers of the 1980s, right? 1880s, sorry. So she found there, and she looked at her grandfather, and she looked at my grandfather's brother's picture, and they looked almost identical to her, and she thought that she found us, and she was right.
Wow.
And so they came to visit us at my parents' house, and the moment that they walked in, we all knew that they were family. And the reason we knew this is because a lot of the men in my family, they have very, very, very blue eyes and very black eyebrows that are almost connected. And in walks this dude with very, very blue eyes and these connected black eyebrows. And I'm like, okay, we don't need to look for it anymore. But then they wanted to do DNA tests, and we did, and we're family. And that's how that happened.
Mishpoka.
And the funny thing for me is that all of a sudden, a lot of the folks, Palestinian folks I worked with doing field work, somehow became related to my family.
Did it change how people viewed you once they learned you were also Palestinian?
Yes. What was strange for me is that my positions, ideas, views, the way I live in the world did not change at all, except I now had this wonderful family. But that Palestinians were really interested in the story, and it kind of gave me a pedigree, maybe, that it was okay, that might have been more difficult before with some folks. There was a documentary that was done on this on Israeli TV, which I don't appreciate much, but folks in Israel felt like it was the untold story of what this place could and should have been like for those who would care for peace and so on.
Well, thanks for opening up and sharing your life, which I had no clue you had a mythical family or anything. Like, this is news to me as well.
Mean, I don't know if mythical is quite the word, but there are a lot of really amazing, bizarre stories. I mean, there aren't a lot of Israelis who have, a Muslim saint in their genealogy.
I want to spend the last part of Gaza Corner changing the topic completely. Israeli officials, Donald Trump, they've made no secret about their aim of erasing, in a sense, erasing Gaza as a Palestinian territory and removing its population. I just learned of a poll put out by Hebrew University. I don't know if you saw it, where an overwhelming majority of Jewish Israelis share the what I would call the genocidal belief that there are quote unquote no innocent people in Gaza. There's actually an article linked at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist. Thank you, Harry. And it's the one from Mondo Weiss. And it's important to realize this dehumanization of Palestinians did not begin recently, did not begin October 7th. It's been around a long time. I remember Avigdor Lieberman, then the defense minister in 2018, he said there are no innocent people in the Gaza Strip. And then the other one that I remember really well was from, and I may pronounce her name incorrectly, Ayelet Shaked. And she was not then the justice minister. She was a Jewish home lawmaker in the Knesset. And she shared a media post. This was in 2014 during one of Israel's, what I would term a genocidal assault on Gaza. 2,200 Palestinians were killed, over 550 children. And she wrote, "Who is the enemy? The Palestinian people. Behind every terrorist stand dozens of men and women without whom he could not engage in terrorism. They should follow their sons. Nothing would be more just. They should go, as should the physical homes in which they raised the snakes. Otherwise, more little snakes will be raised there." And there are just many genocidal statements. Many were brought to the fore by South Africa in its case in the at the International Court of Justice against Israel. So there are many factors.
Let me correct that the ones that brought forth were the ones that were by the current coalition. The ones that went to the International Court of Justice were ones by the current coalition. Statements that were made after, you know,
after October 7th. Yeah, that's true.
And you're speaking of previous folks. Ayelet Shaked was part of a fascist party run by Bennett, who might make a comeback now. Everybody's looking at him.
Natalie Bennett, yeah.
Exactly. And Avigdor Lieberman has always held ethnic cleansing as a way of settling the problem, right? That's not a new thing. And in some ways, there were those kinds of statements that were made that were not really supported by a lot of folks, and you would see a lot of editorials against them and so on and so forth. Not that things were good, but I think we're in a whole other kind of phase.
Yeah, now, what I would say is that those statements were not necessarily at that point. We didn't know. I mean, people, just like in the United States, a whole lot of people were racist, but were a little close to the vest about it until Donald Trump said it's okay to show your colors. Maybe the same thing in Israel, maybe not. But now, for sure, what you describe as fascism is the dominant government in Israel. And the fact that such an overwhelming majority of the population of Israel want Gaza to be depopulated and rid of Palestinians speaks to the absolute dehumanization that's taken place. And I just want to know from your standpoint, what are the primary factors? I mean, it's got to be censorship, propaganda, whatever it is. What comes to mind to you that so many people could have so much hatred?
I don't think it's just that so many people could have so much hatred. I think it's narratives that get pumped constantly. I think you're right. I think there's a lot of censorship. People here don't see anything that happens in Gaza. And there's, how should I say it, ongoing consciousness engineering that I can just see it unfold constantly, right? So some of the acts of censorship came pretty soon, right after October 7th. And those were getting rid of Al Jazeera, which is the one channel that fed a lot of people in the region of other things that were going on.
Can you talk about like Channel 14, for example, which is sort of like the Fox News equivalent in Israel and the role it plays?
Worse than the Fox News, I think, yeah. Because Fox News, how should I say it? It's really Bibi's channel. Mm. It's Netanyahu's channel. Channel 14 is the coalition's channel, and it is the most well-funded, and all the other channels, which aren't great at all. I want to speak about the mainstream media here and about how consciousness engineering sort of goes on, because the reality that is created here is really an alternative reality that largely is Totally always representing the IDF.
The
Always
Israeli Defense Force, for folks who don't know. Yeah.
exactly. I started speaking about censorship. I don't know if folks know this, but no foreign journalists are allowed into Gaza. And increasingly, they're really banned from what's going on in the West Bank. People that try to do it, not just Al Jazeera, even Israeli journalists, they can't go into Gaza except by being hosted by the IDF, who shows them only what they want to show.
Can't international journalists also do that, be embedded with the IDF and have their reports screened before they're released?
I think originally they were. I don't think there are any more of
Really?
those now.
Okay.
I or maybe if they are, they're very few and far between, because I don't think Israel wants what's going on in Gaza to be seen right now.
Okay.
So what we have is a lot of ministers. This one wants to throw an atom bomb on Gaza. This one wants to transfer the entire population, on and on and on. There's a total media blackout on what's really going on there, as well as on what's going on in the West Bank. Once in a while, there's a story that manages to creep out of the cracks. For example, the paramedics story. The 15 paramedics that were killed by the IDF and buried while they were on the way to save folks who had been bombed. Gaza.
Because there was absolute video proof disputing what the Israeli
So
narrative
many
was. Yeah.
international channels had got their hands on that video proof, right?
Yeah.
But this happens occasionally. For me, I feel like sometimes I want to bang my head on the wall because it feels like such a split consciousness. Like what you hear in the media is that another Hamas, whatever small leader it has remained that has been taken out by the IDF, has been killed, and more terror infrastructure has been dead. It's always terror infrastructure, right? And then I look at my feed, and the Al-Baqa cafe that was just bombed, and it was this beautiful artist who was killed, and so on and so. And then it's like this. Only last week we know about the Gaza Humanitarian Fund, right? Which should be called the Gaza Homicide Fund. We know about that.
Well, for folks
I've
who
been.
don't know, it's the concoction between Israel and the Trump administration to ostensibly allow some aid into Gaza, but instead it became an absolute killing field for people queuing up for food. There were more than 400 distribution sites for food prior to this that were controlled by UNRWA, the UN organization, and
UNRWA and the World Central Kitchen and
yes,
other folks,
and
but
others.
this one.
And this one had four, now one, and hardly operating at all. But people are dying every day queuing up for food.
Right. And the narrative here is we've given away so many millions of meals, right? As though these meals are coming in on trays, like you go, on an airplane, you get your tray of food. And what it really is going on is people are coming in from miles away because they have nothing near them, the way that humanitarian aid should be provided, and they're shot at. And there's hundreds that have died, and they're shot at for inexplicable reasons. And so that story has just broken out here about a week ago on Haaretz, which gets maybe what, about 4% readership?
And also lost their government funding as well in December of 2024.
And now there's a after this story broke out in Haaretz, there's a mayor of this town in the south of Israel who has banned Haaretz from the town entirely,
Yeah,
right?
which he can't do, actually. He can't legally.
Yes, but that's the
Yeah.
that this is the environment
That's the
that
That's the mentality.
all of this kind of narrative is. It's the same in the West Bank. I'm thinking about 40,000 people have been displaced from the refugee camps of Jenin and other places in the northern West Bank because they keep talking about terrorist infrastructure, on and on and on and on and on. And then the story that I see is that they show what they seized, which was 82 rifles. And for this, you've basically displaced 40,000 people and have run roads through the refugee camps, destroyed so many houses to make them supposedly safe, and so these people can't go back.
Let me just share this quote, and we're running out of time, unfortunately. We could talk for so long. There's another article at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist. It says, Inside Israel's Disturbing Denial of Starvation in Gaza. I'll read a quote from Gilad Erdan, Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. The quote is, if there is even a problem of lack of food in Gaza, and we claim otherwise, only the Hamas terrorists are to blame who loot humanitarian aid that Israel allows to enter with no limitations. Every word in there is
a
lie.
This is the kind of narrative that people keep. And so that then they don't understand what's going on. And when they don't understand what's going on, A, everybody's a terrorist. B, the world is anti-Semitic.
And C, there's been no evidence that Hamas is looting either.
Maybe we can end. I kind of went back to what I wrote about the kind of consciousness engineering that is going on, because there are so many narratives that when these narratives keep getting repeated again and again and again, they start to reuse them again and again. It just becomes the narrative that is told. And for folks who are not like me and who don't look at foreign media and don't have folks in all kinds of places, including the West Bank, who write to me and so on, they have another idea about what's really going on. So what I wrote at the end of this is...
When you say wrote, you mean on your Facebook page?
Yes. War is peace, peace is war, and my brain cannot process all the wonderful things in store for all the poor souls between the river and the sea, who must live and die under this regime, most especially for those who must die. Up next, death is life. Life is death.
Neely Belkind. That's Belkind. Thank you so much, Neely. It's so informative, and you share so much of your own self, and I really, really appreciate it as KALW and Tangents listeners and Gaza Corner listeners truly, truly appreciate what you've been able to share with us these last couple of Gaza Corners. Neely is an author, an ethnomusicologist, co-curator of the Rough Guide to Palestine.
You know, since we're transitioning from talk to music, Dory, maybe we can just play what just came into my feed from Jawan Safadi, who is an artist that I've worked with and wrote about. And I think this particular song is very right for the moment, both for what's going on in the U.S. and for what's going on over here.
Thank you, Neely.
I am a semi like you used to be. I'm the Semite that no one wants to see. I call you out on your crimes. You call me anti-Semite and flip the reality. I am the Semite. I'm the refugee living in your ghetto and dying to be free. I am a Semite who still has to face white people wipe his people and take their place, demonize their race. I wonder in this case, who would the anti-Semite be? I am the Semite. I'm the refugee living in your ghetto, dying to be free. You force me to fight. What else can I do? I'm not anti-Semite, I'm not an anti-Jew. I'm a Jew, more than you. My genes can prove, or take a look at me. You will see the Semite. You will see the refugee living in your ghetto. dying to be free.